Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You could text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. I want to thank my last guest, Ms. Maria Castillo and David Muhammad of Milwaukee County Department of Health and Human Services. And so Sandy is back. And Sandy, I really, and Mike, I see you. We'll come to you. And can we bring Mike on quickly? Am I going to be able to hear him?
I can't hear.
Mike? Are you there, Mike?
Yes, I'm here, Earl.
Hello, Mike. Okay, so we've got some technical difficulties. We'll come back to you, Mike. In the meantime, Sandy.
Yeah.
Ukraine is not going anywhere, and Russia is not going anywhere. And I just heard you say something that stopped me dead in my tracks. You off the air, you said, well... There it is. Yeah. All right.
There we go.
All right, Mike, you can call back. We got it worked out. But, Sandy, you said that off the air that Russia went into Ukraine because of their worries about NATO.
Well, I mean, that's what Putin was saying, and I think...
Do you believe that?
I believe that... That part of it, you know, I can't
right.
speak to all of the motives.
Right.
Some of it might be simply restoring some of the, at least the Russian speaking portions.
But the NATO
of the
part of it, but
one.
The NATO part of it, nobody's talking about that part.
Well, they talked about it in the beginning. I mean, but it wasn't. I don't think it was understood enough on our side. He was talking about it a lot because Russia has had this view about NATO ever since. You know, in 1991, there was supposedly the conversation between George Bush the First and Gorbachev at the time of the reunification of Germany, in which Bush assured Gorbachev that NATO wasn't going to move into the old Warsaw Pact countries. They weren't going to move one inch into the old countries, so they could be confident, Russia could be confident that there wasn't going to be this threat to Russia of hostility of a hostile NATO. And then almost immediately, within years, within 4 years, 5 years, and then 8 years, and you know. Much of the Warsaw Pact countries were brought into NATO, and then including some immediately adjacent to Russia, like Latvia and Estonia. And
so, Sandy, before you go any further, for people who don't understand the history of it in those Warsaw Bloc nations you were talking about, they all used to be a part of the USSR?
No, they weren't part of the USSR. The Warsaw Bloc countries were the Iron Curtain countries. And so these countries were Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary.
Okay.
The list, you know, and the only ones that were actually part of the USSR were the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
Okay.
They were part of the USSR. And those became then a part of NATO, which was a sort of a direct stick in the eye. And they were immediately adjacent to Russia and also in control of some important Baltic Sea areas. And so Russia had become increasingly concerned. At one point in the early 2000s, we were talking to Russia about joining NATO, which of course would have made NATO kind of superfluous other than as a peacekeeping force between all the members of NATO. And then we dropped those conversations and instead continued conversations with the likes of Latvia, Lithuania. And also in 2014 and on after that, we began to have talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO, which Ukraine is a very big country that sticks into Russia and has been historically played a significant role in the USSR and in the Romanov Empire, and so that was very troublesome. And in November, I think it was November 10th of 2021, Biden signs an agreement. Blinken, his Secretary of State, sign a strategic charter agreement with Ukraine saying, well, we'll welcome you into NATO. And all of that had a lot to do, we think, some of us think, with the invasion by Putin into Ukraine, because he wanted to take control of Ukraine in a manner that would cause it never to become a member of NATO. So you know, what's happened since then in the war has been that the West and NATO countries in particular, have provided a great deal of resource to Ukraine and have permitted Ukraine to successfully defend itself thus far, and maybe even in some cases to gain the upper hand on the battlefield with respect to Putin, who was conducting a somewhat limited campaign in terms of the invasion into Ukraine. He did not mobilize the armed forces in a warlike manner. Now, you know, there's a saying that wars start on the battlefront and end at home. And so there is a problem that Putin has with respect to domestic affairs within Russia, because, while he's authoritarian, essentially close to a dictator in terms of his control of Russia, that control is based to some extent on the tacit recognition of him as a leader by the people and not having too much hostile reaction to his actions by the people. Putin's popularity actually went up during the early period of the Ukrainian war. It seemed to represent, in many respects, make America great again. He was making Russia great again, standing up to the United States. But now with the mobilization, the reality of this war and the fact that it's going to inflict a great deal of pain on a great number of families in Russia, just as Vietnam inflicted pain on families here in the United States, has the potential, to cause a different reaction on the home front. But all of this is troubling because, to some extent, what Russia says is an echoing of what Biden said, maybe in error, but if it was a Freudian slip, somewhat in the early days of the Ukrainian war, he said that we were going to help Ukraine hold on as long as possible because it would weaken Russia. And of course, those words, when you translate them from the Russian side, sound pretty damaging. Pretty daunting.
So now you see, here we are, the winter's around the corner, and clearly Vladimir Putin is saying, okay, so enough of playing games. We're going to show Ukraine. We are going to crush them. They're going to see the real might, the real power of our nation. We're calling up these 300,000 troops. They think that they've been in a war, but now we're really going to show them.
Yes. That clearly is what is the move that Putin is making. And to some extent, I was talking before your last guest about how the Federal Reserve Bank has a hammer, and they have to make sure that the public understands that they're willing to use it in order to get rid of inflationary psychology. Right. You have to persuade the people that you're not going to let inflation take a grip. That has to do essentially with negotiating with the public, trying to get them into a psychological frame of mind that, look, we're not going to let inflation happen, so don't start spending money today like there's going to be inflation. Well, what Putin's doing is a bit like that. I mean, to some extent, he's declaring to the public and to Ukraine the fact that, look, I've got a big hammer. I've got nuclear weapons. I've got 300,000 troops I can call up, and that's just the beginning. That's just round one of a mobilization that could involve many more people. And so you ought to understand that whereas you maybe had a near-term battlefield victory in a portion of the Donbas region, I'm now going to take all the steps necessary to make sure that this war will come to roost at your feet. And so you better negotiate with me now, and let's negotiate a peace that isn't premised on the notion that you're going to take back the Donbass or take back Crimea. So I think that's what he's trying to set the table for.
So while he is clearly stating that puts the United States in the shadow of decision, because what we've been giving Ukraine is not going to suffice with Russia starting to ramp up this war.
I mean, That's this game. I mean, number one, the game, you can't be bluffing, or you can't appear to be bluffing, right, or otherwise it doesn't matter what you say. So Putin, I suspect, will stand behind his words. He is going to go through with the mobilization. He is trying to strengthen his hand, however, I believe, for a negotiation in which he can go to, and he started this annexation of the Donbas regions. Now, there's a very tactical reason for that. If that becomes part of the Soviet, that becomes part of the Russian territory and isn't just an independent country, but now is Russia. He's going to accuse Ukraine of invading Russia if they set foot with soldiers into the annexed regions. Now, that's a, you know, these rules of law, the rules of this law seem a little strange. Russia has sent many feet into Ukraine,
right,
but they've drawn a red line and said, you don't set any feet into Russia or you will have hell to pay. And I guess the hell to pay that he's hanging out there
weapons.
Is potentially tactical nuclear
yeah.
weapons, because he's going to be then defending the sovereign land of Russia. So, you know, he's doing all these tactics right now. To me, it smells like someone who is putting all these chess men on the table. He's saying, this is what I'm going to play. Now let's talk.
But at the same time, the United States is waving their finger and saying, we're hearing you talk about nuclear weapons. Hey, you better watch that.
Well, our response is pretty much like his response. He's using strategic
right.
ambiguity about when and if he's going to use nuclear weapons, and we're using strategic ambiguity about how it is we'll respond if he does.
So is this just one-upmanship, or should we be concerned about it?
International affairs is always about, to some extent, the perception of the other side, and you're trying to accomplish something. There is the potential for negotiation that has been ongoing. Apparently, Erdogan and Turkey had negotiation pretty far down the road until something fell apart, which some are saying was Zelensky deciding that he was getting the upper hand on
yeah.
the battlefield, so he wasn't willing to talk at the point that Erdogan had the table set for it. I think that if I look optimistically at what's happening, this is Putin trying to reset the table for a negotiation in which he has more leverage than he would have if he initiated a negotiation after the apparent battlefield victories in and around Kherson.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I can't help but the more I see the president of Ukraine, why do I keep Zelensky? The more that I keep watching him, and he appears to get to be speaking stronger and stronger.
Well, you understand, when a war starts, first of all, there's no truth that it comes out of the battlefront. You get filtered news
yeah.
from both sides. And the leaders of both sides have to appear truculent and strong.
Yeah, bravado.
Bravado. It's required. You know, if you whimper, number one, your troops will lose morale. Your people won't do what they need to do. And the other side will it's like a football team that doesn't have fans cheering, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
Can't get up for the game.
Yeah. So what we see is does not necessarily reflect what's actually going on. However, I think what's happened recently in Ukraine is that these apparent battlefield victories, and you understand battlefields ebb and flow. When someone takes the offensive like Ukraine has and inserts their troops and penetrates the battle lines of the other side, it is a battlefield victory for a while, but it also creates vulnerability on your flanks. And so, you know, if you understand battlefield strategy, if you project yourself into the other side's domain, now you're exposed on the flanks and you're,
right.
you're subject to getting cut off. We found that out in World War II in the Battle of the Bulge. And so, you know, we'll have to look backwards after a couple of months to figure out just how much these victories meant. But with these apparent victories, it has probably put wind in the sails of Zelensky, thinking that he has is gaining more negotiating strength. I do think that the war is still what the public is seeing, and what is behind the scenes is the potential diplomatic settlement. Ultimately, a war like this gets settled diplomatically.
Isn't it always easier to defend than for Russia to have for the nation that's attacking?
Yes, attacking is more difficult. So Russia found that out when they were on the attack, and Ukraine has been on the defense, and now Ukraine has been on the offense and has had successful incursions into Russia, probably because of logistical issues Russia has with supplying its lines with all sorts of things, including munitions. But What Putin is doing now is trying to demonstrate to Ukraine that he is going to put Russia in a position where they will no longer have that sort of weakness in the battlefield, and they will have more strengths. So he's trying to demonstrate to both Ukraine and, I guess, the rest of the world that Russia is in this, and they're in it for the long haul, and that regardless of the weaponry that's supplied to Ukraine by the West, that he's going to take the steps necessary to overwhelm them. And that is, I think, being done at this stage with the level of hope on the Russian side that this bombast will create a negotiating situation that could get this thing settled on a basis that they could settle on and that Ukraine could settle on.
So Putin has reconciled whatever the cost. Whatever the cost to Russia, to the people, to our economy, we have to save face.
Well, he's making a huge, you know, he's an autocrat, so he doesn't really have to stand for re-election for a long time. So his power is basically premised on his capacity to tell the people what to do, and they will do it. It's a little bit like the importance of meeting norms in the United States. The norm in Russia is that when Putin tells you to do something, you do it, or else you'll get pushed down the steps or pushed out a window or poisoned with Novichok or whatever. But there's a limit to how much that sort of autocratic power can be flexed in the circumstance in which lots of people are saying nyet instead of da. Okay? And so everyone does understand that by a full mobilization of Russia, he's potentially creating the numbers of Russians who will say nyet into a larger and unwieldy group of people which he might lose power. So, like I said earlier, wars are started on the battlefield and lost at home. And so there is a potential that Putin's position will weaken. Now, as I said earlier, Putin's position at the onset of the Ukrainian war was he became more popular.
He's got to save face in this, Sandy, one way or the other. And so when he talks about mobilizing 300,000 troops, what about all these people who are trying to get out?
That's my point. He's going to do this, and an autocrat can order people around in the country until finally, so many people are disaffected saying yet that it doesn't work anymore. And that has happened in other countries, populist uprisings, people just turning their back on the government. But I wouldn't count on it in the near term, and that's what he's basically, that's the position he's assuming as well, is don't count on that in the near term. I've got a firm grip. I'm going to do these things. Sit down and talk with me, because if he could reach a negotiated settlement in the near term, all of that problem could go away for him domestically.
Well, you know, it's any way it goes, be it Putin or be it Zelensky, the settlements are going to be a hard pill to swallow on both sides because of, you know, you've been boxing for 15 rounds or 14 rounds,
right.
And then there's been a measure taken of both men.
Well, I like I said in the beginning, I do think that a Russian settlement that gave Crimea, the annexation of Crimea, official recognition, and that the Donbass region as well essentially was either annexed or created an autonomous situation, that, and as well a commitment on the part of Ukraine not to join NATO, which was something Zelensky put on the table in about after 6 weeks of war. He said, you know, we don't want to go in NATO. We aren't going to go in NATO. So I think there is a settlement, but as this war goes on and as Ukraine begins to get the smell of the potential of taking back some of the Donbass region or taking back Crimea, the Krem, you know, maybe it becomes less likely that that's the framework for the settlement. I will say this, that there has always been a notion that there are a fair number of Russian sympathists and separatists in Donbass and in Crimea as well, and that could be a problem for Zelensky.
We got to go to a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. Sandy, I want to switch up and ask you about your thoughts on a state legislature that won't allow the city of Milwaukee to raise resources to fund itself. You know, the county executive right now is asking for a 1% sales tax increase in order to allow the Milwaukee County what the resources that it needs so dearly to be able to continue to function. City of Milwaukee, a 1 cent sales tax. You know, and I was talking about this earlier in the week. I read where the city of Milwaukee, it's going to take 40 years just to fix the lights, Sandy, the street lights. We can't, no resources to. And so we're at a point, Sandy, where why can't we get the state to why would they want to see Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee not be able to function? Because next year, when the chickens come home to roost for a, you know, and $100 million that's going to have to go towards pensions.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no money. What are they going to do? What are they trying to do? Starve us out?
Well, it's hard to understand. It's strictly rural versus urban warfare, and it's strictly dog in the manger. It's like you know, the dog. I'm not sure why it's called dog in the manger, but that's the strategy of making the other person hurt because it makes you feel better when the other person hurts. And why would they do it? I mean, clearly, Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee need additional revenue sources to deal with the issues they have. They're no longer growing at the rate they were growing at in the 20s and 30s with a huge, you know, a burgeoning tax base so that it was easy to build parks and do all this
stuff.
Yeah,
it hasn't been that way for a long time.
It hasn't been that way for a long time. And the state government has the income tax, which of course is a revenue source that goes up with growing incomes, with inflation it goes up. All these things take it up, but the county doesn't have it. Has a property tax basis for its revenue,
limited,
and it's limited. But it's got a ceiling on it, and the property tax base isn't going up at a rapid rate at all. So what do we have? We've got rapidly rising costs without a rapidly rising tax base and a source of revenue, and we've got a state government that is in a position to give us an additional revenue source, but they're kind of putting their hands around our neck and saying no. And
it's a recipe for disaster.
Well, and also is a recipe for the kind of calls that we get from conservatives on the phone who tell us that, you know, the problems with cities is they're run by Democrats.
Right.
And if, you know, the Republicans ran the cities, they wouldn't be like this. It's the Democrats that are running them into the ground. No. The problems of the cities are related to the circumstances of the cities. And one of the circumstances of the cities is they don't have revenue sufficient to deal with all the issues they've got. Cities have dense population, okay? other parts of the state don't have dense population. Dense population brings its own problems, and it's more expensive and different to deal with a population that is dense in how right. it's located, and also has within the density a significant portion of the poverty that exists in the whole state exists in this densely populated city.
You know,
and
what comes along with that is more garbage, more crime, more police and fire.
Exactly.
All of those entities are going to come with densely populated areas.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the rural areas, many of them have volunteer fire departments, okay? They have garbage dumps that people take their stuff to. They've got county and state highways that are plowed by other people. Right? And so it's a whole different ballgame. When you've got a municipality, a county, or a city, you've got a whole bunch of expenses that are borne by the municipality that have to be supported by the tax base of the municipality.
But the legislature is aware of that. I mean, if these people are aware of it, they just choose not to want to support. It's a matter of not even supporting, it's giving them the tools.
To be honest with you, instead of giving Milwaukee the tools, they're giving them the bird. You know, really.
Well, really.
They're flashing the bird to the city saying, look, you're asking for something, we could give it to you, but we're not going to do it. And why aren't you going to do it? I mean, the pain is experienced by those who spend the money in the city.
Right.
Now, one of the problems in Milwaukee County, I suppose, is that the communities around Milwaukee County that aren't in the county are strongly conservative, or at least Republican-based, right? So you've got Washington County, Ozaukee County, Waukesha County.
Brown County.
These counties spend their money in the city.
Right.
They don't want to pay the sales tax, I suppose, in the city that they thrive because of, right? The municipalities or the suburbs and counties around Milwaukee County thrive in large part because they're close to Milwaukee County. If you took Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee away and just took it out of the whole process, what would you have?
I know. So Sandy, this is not a game, you know. I mean, it's serious consequences tied into the way this has been going, and it's not even so much. And yesterday I heard Robin Voss for the first time mm-hmm. say, maybe we'll look at what they're asking. Because under then County Executive Chris Abley and Mayor Tom Barrett, there was no looking at anything. We're just not going to give them anything.
Well, yay for Cavalier Johnson. Actually, I do think when he was running, and I think he has demonstrated a capacity to talk across the aisle.
So is David Crowley.
Yeah, and David Crowley, yeah. But that's what I meant, David Crowley. And so these people, I think, are going to do a better job of representing the interests of the county. But I think the problem is really that it's this antipathy, this outlier antipathy to the county and the city that is a problem.
But can the state of Wisconsin really afford to have Milwaukee County in ruins? I don't think they can.
Well, you know, I mean, the problem is that the politics ignore reality in so many ways. And you can see that in the MAGA politics, so many people who are MAGA supporters are voting against their real interest and are essentially aligned with something that is really not necessarily in their real interest, at least their economic interest. And the same is true, I think, with respect to the politics of rural versus city. It's become such a doctrine that cities are something to which we are not going to send money. We're going to strangle them. It's the Grover Norquist version of political warfare.
You know, Sandy, I had State Senator Chris Larson on yesterday, and he said, okay, so they haven't, the legislature hasn't been in session since March, and they're not going back until next year.
These guys are full-time employees.
It's yeah, and so for all of this time, almost a year, mm-hmm. with $5 billion sitting in the coffers
right.
at the state level, just sitting there. When this is a good time, right, to be, you should be together and working out ways to deal with these things. They have just steadfastly said, no, Governor Evers, we're not going to allow you to call. We're not coming back into session. We don't care what you say. You're not going to wind up with any credit because we want to see you gone. And we want to see Tim Michaels. I'm a businessman. They want him to be the next governor. So let everybody else suffer. This is the politics we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact is that there's very little for the opposition to Evers to point at to say that something's going wrong in Wisconsin. But they can make it go wrong by not giving enough revenue to a place like Milwaukee
right.
to deal with the issues they do have. And it's at a time when the state, which is what Evers runs, is very flush. I mean,
there's no economic
problem at the state government level in the state government that's run by Evers. He's had initiatives that have worked with, that are working to try to solve some of these more localized problems, and he's got resistance from the opposing party. The opposing party running against him, as far as I can tell, hasn't listed anything that's gone bad in Wisconsin.
No.
All that they talk about is inflation and things over which I think...
And crime.
And the city crime, which is located in cities,
right.
And cities that are strangled for revenue, and you know it's not as if the governor is establishing the policies that would relate to the urban issue of urban safety.
You know, Sandy, really, to be honest, Governor Evers has really kind of done a great job. I mean, I don't think people really expect it.
Well, look, if he wasn't doing a good job, we would all know his name. Because the opposing party would be using his name all the time,
right.
pointing at all the mistakes he's making. But he's not that well known because he has quietly and efficiently
led
and done a good job as governor. And as a result, the Republicans have very little bad to say about him personally or even from a policy standpoint.
And they want that seat back in the worst way. And they've got to do everything within their power because there are even Republicans who have to say, hey, he's done a good job.
Well, you know, the stalemate has been the policy in politics since the 1990s. And the party that's in power that isn't sitting in the governor's office wants to make sure that nothing happens that the governor can claim as victory, just as what happened to Obama when he lost the House the second 2 years of his term and from then on. So stalemate, and part of stalemate, for instance, is to do nothing for Milwaukee. That would require an affirmative vote to give us something. We aren't going to get it, and it's the result of stalemate.
So you know a little bit about state government. You work for a former governor of the state of Wisconsin, and so you've got at least a position to speak from having watched the way that governor ran the state and how this governor's running the state.
Well, you know, that period in the 70s was a period when actually both parties
worked together.
Well, they were, in fact, working for the benefit of the state, and they were not simply working for the benefit of
a party
power.
Right.
That began to change a little. There was a fellow named John Shabazz, who was the head of the Republican minority in the Assembly, and he was very strident about people being party-line Republicans, and he was a Waukesha fellow. He became a federal judge out here. But back then, it was basically a bunch of people who were first Wisconsinites, and then they were political party partisans, and so things did get done, and it wasn't there wasn't the dog in the manger approach to let's make sure nothing good happens on his watch because he's from the other party or she's from the other party, but. That has become the norm now, and it's become the norm nationally as well as locally.
You know, Sandy, and the worst part about it is, I don't even know how you get around it anymore. This has gotten so entrenched, and then the media outlets
Well, I think
help pour gas on the fire.
I think it's gotten so entrenched because of the we, they. It's become, they have become such evil persona in the eyes of we that it's very important that we maintain power at any cost. And that's become the political outlook, and it's because we no longer attribute to them patriotism or the bona fide interest of the public. And so when that happens, then stalemate is what you're doing as a loyal patriot.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. Welcome back to the last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us that same number. You know, I was asking Sandy off the air. Maybe I was reading more into it than I should, but it looked like Robin Voss was, for the first time, separating himself and acting as an individual when the question was asked of him whether or not, you know, the city, the county is asking for these resources. And I heard him say, and I might have had one eye open and one eye closed at the time, and he said, maybe we'll take a look at that again, you know.
Well, I think Robin Voss maybe has had an epiphany.
Wait, let me write that down. Robin Voss, isn't that an oxymoron?
No, I think he had an epiphany that related to, you know, what happens if you get in bed with the wrong people in politics, they can bite you. He played along with the MAGA Republicans. He appointed Gableman. Gableman then went totally rogue, and I think he looked at it and said, "Wow, this guy has gone rogue," and it turned out that it bit him badly. You know, they ended up with running people against Robin
Voss. And he just barely survived.
Yeah, and so maybe he's realized that you need to put principle over bear partisanship, that maybe the enemy is not so clearly the liberals. Maybe the enemy is people who don't have the Wisconsin's best interest in mind. Maybe he realized that the activities that were going on around him did not have Wisconsin's best interests in mind. And so, you know, I applaud him if the epiphany he's had is that he needs to look at things with the eyes first of what's good for Wisconsin without first running it through a filter of whether it's bad for them.
You know, Sandy, and he is now in a position, because he's got another 4 years, he's in a position now to wield his power for the right reasons now, and the right things, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Which is, you know, I think long overdue.
Yeah, and I'd be surprised if he was. It was easy for him to build up much enmity or animosity towards someone like Evers. I think Evers has a lot of advantages. One of them is that he's not a confrontational guy. He's not. He has not spent a lot of time trying to embarrass his opposition,
right,
or point fingers.
And he's been willing to work with
him. Yes, and so he's getting stuff stuff done. And maybe Voss is going to look at this and realize that he'd much rather get stuff done than have things like the disaster in Racine with the Foxconn thing.
Well, you know, Sandy,
let's make up for that.
His legacy. You're right. He's been around long enough now that that you know, he doesn't have to worry about those things anymore. Maybe this might be his last term. He's wealthy enough that he doesn't have to worry about money. It's a matter of now, you know, legacy. And maybe some of those things before, all of those people he was with originally, Fitzgerald, Walker, Ryan, and others, are no longer there. He's kind of like the last guy standing of that group.
Well, yeah, and I just hope, you know, we started on the county tax issue, and I just hope that this dog and manger, this total partisanship, where the notion is deadlock to make sure that nothing good happens on the watch of your opposition. I hope that whole outlook can be dropped in politics generally, but certainly here in Wisconsin at home and nationally. I mean, it's become a bad disease. You know, the notion that you can't let something good happen to the country on the watch of your opposition because they'll get credit for it.
And you know, back in those days, Wisconsin was always looked at as one of the states with clean politics. When I was a young boy,
we had clean politics. We had clean government. We were known as the state of good government.
Right.
People would come to Wisconsin and copy our rules and regulations and laws because it all worked.
Right.
You know, we were known, and the University of Wisconsin treated the state as a laboratory for good policy, and it all worked. And you know, what have we been doing for the last while? Well, we've been denigrating our university. We've been changing our whole approach to we've turned government into a bad guy, just like we did on a national basis. And so, you know, my hope is that we can start a change here, at least close to home.
You know, Sandy, I think there's at least for the first time in a long time some hope. You know, and I think it's ushered in by, again, two new faces, and on the county level and on the city level. I think the animosity between the county executive then, Chris Abley, a strong-willed man, mm-hmm. and Tom Barrett, a strong-willed man, was a lot more difficult for the state to handle long-term guys than these two young guys who are now there.
Yeah, I mean, I think these guys, both of them, I think have shown a great deal of pragmatism, a great deal of capacity to do what's needed for the good of what they're in charge of doing. And that's what we need. You know, that's absolutely what we need. We need a pragmatic approach to things. I think Mandela Barnes is promising the same kind of down-to-earth pragmatism and not strident partisanship.
All right, I think we got to wrap it up. Sandy, as always, it's great. We'll be seeing each other again on Monday. Hope you enjoy the weekend. Word to the wise, Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Dress warmly.
Yeah, don't go down to the river again at 45 degrees. All right, we got to go. Thank you, Connor, for a great week. Thank everybody for a great week. We'll be back on Monday. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.